Hey guys, this is our weekly podcast by Cornerstone Church of Ione. We're so glad that you decided to join. We are a church family passionate about seeing people worship Jesus, grow in their faith, and serve those around them. If you would like to learn more about Cornerstone, please visit us at cornerstoneione.org, or you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
And I just remind you to turn off your cell phones. You know, nobody ever reminds you about that anymore, and I was actually speaking at a graveside service last weekend, and somebody's cell phone went off. That old time rock and roll. And I could have sworn I turned it off before I got there. Talk about embarrassing. You ever buy a car? Anybody ever bought a car? A few of you, huh? Not too many. I guess everybody's walking or riding horses. I bought a few cars in my day, and I have discovered that there's a kind of a, I didn't plan it, it's just kind of a system, a way I go through things. You know, I start by giving kind of a general overview of a vehicle. So, you know, the first thing you do is you just kind of look at it and think, does it deserve me to do any more looking? You know, I remember one time walking out of this building and got out to the steps here, and Karen goes, "Oh, I want that car," you know? And it happened to be for sale. And the reason she wanted it, it was red. I'm not kidding. Is that true, Karen? Yeah. See, and that's okay. I made fun of her. Of course, I don't like to pass up an opportunity like that. But I don't blame her. I mean, that's the first thing you do is you just kind of give a general look. Now, is this a vehicle that I want to give another look to? So you kind of a general overview. Okay, it looks like about the size of the car I want. It's got the right color, you know. And so you walk over and you look a little closer, you know, and it's still kind of a general thing, you know. You're looking, wondering what the mileage is, its general condition, the asking price. You know, these are all general things that you have to decide on. It's that first casual inspection that could reveal some obvious damage, you know, like a dented fender, a bad touch-up paint job, indications that it suffered some damage in an inferior car wash. You know, these are just general things that you want to look for before you decide whether or not you want to purchase that vehicle. And I think that particular vehicle is up for sale, is it not? No? So you're just generalizing. Then I would go back, if I'm still interested, and I start examining that car or that truck more closely. So I look for obvious signs. Is something amiss in the engine compartment, you know, or you pull off the wheels and start checking the brakes and the bearings and so forth. I used to do that stuff myself. I don't anymore. I really don't work on cars anymore. I used to. I've actually worked from the ground up. I remember I bought a 56 Ford pickup and just took the entire engine apart in the garage and put it all back together. Didn't have nearly the number of parts left over that I thought I would have when I got done, and it worked, and so I guess it was all right. But once they started putting computers in cars, I was out. I'm done. I don't work on them anymore. I changed the oil. That's about it. So in that case, I would call somebody that I know who is good with cars or a mechanic I trust and have them look into it a little more deeply. So that's look for the details now and see if it's still a car I want to buy. So you know, you want them to look, check out the whole engine, the drivetrain, all that kind of stuff. So I find this process to be efficient because if right at the very beginning I look and I go, yuck, I can't stand the color. I don't want to drive a car that's color. So I'm not even going to look any. I'm not going to waste my time on the details, right? But I started looking at it, and I think, you know, that looks like the car that would do the job for me, you know, and maybe I don't care about the color, maybe I don't care that it's all beat up, but there's some other things about it that look good to me. So it's often efficient to take a look at the overview, first of all. Get a picture of what it is that you're looking at, and then dive into the details and see if it all makes sense. Now, just yesterday, as I was just kind of rehearsing this a little bit and going over it, it occurred to me all of a sudden, and this is completely off the topic for this morning, which I'm good at doing. It seems to me like a lot of time we treat people that way. Doesn't it? Yeah, you kind of size them up from a distance and decide whether or not you're interested in finding out any more details. And then you start inspecting a little bit closer. And each place, you know, there's like, well, I can pull out at any time, right? I'm not sure that's a great way. You know, people, I'm not sure people should be treated like vehicles. But I'm afraid that's kind of what, at least what I do. I find myself thinking that from a distance, maybe that person is not somebody I want to pursue. And that could be a huge mistake. It could be that we find out that, like that 56 Ford pickup I had that just looked like somebody beat it up with a bat, it turned out to be the best little truck because everything that was inside that truck was great. Well, anyway, that's my side. Illustrations, of course, break down at some point almost all the time. But the main idea I'm trying to get across here is that the overview, and what we're going to be looking at is an overview of the book of Matthew. The overview, or the general inspection, can give us a good idea of what we're dealing with. And it can make us want to find out what's under the hood. So we look at the overview and we think, I want to know more. And then sometimes we get going into the details later on, and something that we didn't understand in the overview suddenly makes sense. Or the other way around. Something that we thought we understood in the overview, and all of a sudden we get the details and it makes it clear now, and we weren't really understanding it well. So I'm hoping that today we can get this general overview, this general inspection of the book of Matthew today, and then in coming weeks, Brian can get us into the details. And quite honestly, I have no idea where he's going. A couple of weeks ago, I was sitting over here, and he started explaining. Do you remember this? He started explaining how he was thinking about doing Matthew, and then just doing an overview, and then five sections, and then he was going to go to Luke. And I'm sitting there going, oh, man. I may need to pull this kid aside and you know, talk to him about this. I'm still not exactly sure where he's going with this, but I'm beginning to get a better understanding, and we'll find out. He may not know where he's going with this, so. But he'll pull it together. So we're going to start with Matthew, and first of all, we need to know something about the person. I like to know something about the person who is doing the writing. Well, we know his name is Matthew, or do we? He has an AKA. Yeah, he's usually called Matthew, but there's two places where in Mark and Luke where he's called Levi. So it's not unusual. I have two names, Thomas and Bruce, right? Well, I have the last name too, but you know, a lot of us have two names. You know, some people go by their middle name. Some people go by their first name. Some people go by a name that nobody ever gave them. So it's not unusual to have a second name, and Matthew has one. The reason we know that Levi is the same guy as Matthew is because both of these incidents are almost identical to the one in Matthew where he is called by Jesus. And it's almost exactly the same wording. So it's really not disputed that Levi and Matthew are the same person. So when you're reading the scriptures, especially you're reading the Gospels and you see these lists of disciples, and you're reading along, if you're paying attention, like I was when I was a young Christian, you'll see, hey, these don't match up. These 12 guys are not the same as these 12 guys, and they're not the same as these 12 guys. And so I started doing this study and, you know, kind of trying to line them all up, and that's where I started finding out that, yeah, some of them had more than one name. So Matthew goes by Levi just in two places. The rest of the time he's Matthew. I don't think anybody ever called him Matt. Maybe. But we don't have it in Scripture. Now, we also know it's very important to understand from Matthew's standpoint and from the reader's standpoint that Matthew was a Hebrew. Okay, that was very important to them. That was part of why we're going to see in a minute this genealogy. Because if you were a Hebrew, and remember Paul describes himself in one place as a Hebrew of the Hebrews. In other words, I'm not only a Hebrew, I'm a really good Hebrew. And I'm a pure Hebrew. Well, that was really important to them. And it's important to the people Matthew's writing to. So he's a Hebrew, and he's also Jewish. And you go, wait a minute, isn't that redundant? No, people get that wrong all the time. Hebrew is his race. Judaism is his religion. So you can be a Jew without being a Hebrew. Okay, think Ivanka Trump, right? When she married her husband, she converted to Judaism. She's not Hebrew, but she's Jewish. Okay, Sammy Davis Jr., for some of you who are a little more gray hair, you remember him. Converted to Judaism. He certainly was not a Hebrew. The Ethiopian eunuch that Philip talked to, not a Hebrew, but he was a Jew. At least what they didn't call him Jew, but he basically was. He was Jewish. So Matthew, his credentials here are acceptable for the people that he's writing to, because when we get to that part, we're going to see he's writing to people who care about whether he's Hebrew and about whether he's Jewish. And so at this point, we could stop, and everybody in the whole country of Israel in his time would say, all right, Matthew, good guy. That's great. Well, it all goes downhill from here. Because the next thing is, he's a tax collector. Now, I know today, a little different, you know. We still, I think if somebody introduced themselves as a tax collector, you would probably have a few little thoughts. Joe would have 6 or 7 jokes he'd make immediately. But, a tax collector, IRS, still you kind of think, I don't know if I could be your friend. You know? Well, it was even worse in their day. Because a tax collector in Israel in Matthew's day meant that he was an employee of the occupying force of Romans in the country. So he was a traitor. He was working for the enemy. So that didn't make good points with the rest of the people living in the country. Then he also legally cheated and overcharged people. And I say legally because, see, the Romans hire him to collect a certain amount of taxes. And if he gives them that amount of taxes, they're happy. What he does beyond that, they don't care. Because these people aren't Romans. Okay, they're basically the enemy. They've come in and conquered them. And so they really don't care. And so the tax collectors, all of them, not just Matthew, would make a pretty good living off of overcharging. Now, we don't know exactly what kind of tax collector Matthew was. It's been postulated that Matthew didn't go around door to door, collecting taxes, that because he was in Galilee, where a lot of roads, highways came together from other countries, that he may have been collecting tariffs of people coming into the country, caravans coming in, bringing their goods, and he would charge them for that. But nevertheless, he's still a tax collector, and he's still cheating people. He's still overcharging them. Because of that, he becomes part of the economic upper class. Okay, he's got a nice house. He's got his own ski-doo for the Sea of Galilee there. He's got friends in high places. And that puts him at odds with about 95% of the people who lived in Israel who were in poverty level. So there's this economic divide that puts him on the other side as well. Turn page over. So we know that Jesus even acknowledged, not that he approved of, but he at least acknowledged this attitude existed in the country. when in Matthew 18:17, he talks about tax collectors and sinners as if they're one and the same, because they were. Okay, it was just the nature of the job. And so even though he may not have approved of lumping people into that, he at least acknowledged that that was the general thought process and that people generally understood that. So what happens with Matthew? He gets called by Jesus, and we don't really know what happened before that. You know, we just don't know. It's probably easy to assume that since they were in a country area, that he was not completely unaware of who Jesus was. It's certainly, if not likely, at least possible that he had even heard Jesus speak. It's not like, the metropolis. You go to Jerusalem, and, Jesus is speaking over in the northwest area of the city. People in the southeast area, they may never even know that he said anything. But when you're out in the country like that and you're starting to draw crowds, it's reasonable to assume that Matthew at least knew who he was. I think probably had heard him speak as well. I think it would be difficult to just ignore that. That was the entertainment of the day. No TV, no computers. What are you going to do? They love going and listening to people speak and argue and so forth. So I think it's likely that he heard it. But we don't know any of that. All we know is that Jesus at one point walks up to his table and says, Matthew, or Levi in two of the places, come follow me. So Matthew leaves everything and he gets up and follows him. We don't know anything about any discussion that went on. There may have been, but we don't know about any of it. He just gets up and follows him. Very simple. And since Matthew's writing the book, probably figures that's all we need to know. Jesus said, follow, I followed. I wonder what we would think of Matthew today. if he came walking into town, working for the IRS. No, it'd be worse than that. It's hard to come up with I guess we'd have to assume that our country was conquered by somebody first, and then we'd have that same situation. But it'd be difficult. And I wonder what the other disciples thought of Matthew. Here Jesus comes along and says, oh, by the way, let me introduce you to Matthew. And they're all looking at him, yeah, we know Matthew. Yeah, he's been robbing us for years, I kind of wonder how he fit into the crowd. Well, anyway, that's Matthew. Then we go to Matthew the book. We think it was written someplace between 40 and 60 A.D., and we're pretty sure about that. It's just that some people say 40, some say 60. Some people think it was the first gospel written, and that's why it's the first one in the New Testament. Others say no, Mark was first, but we don't really know, and there's really no way to find out. It was written in Greek, although it was written primarily to people who were Jewish. Now, we know that because when you read through the book of Matthew, there's all kinds of indicators that this was written to a Jewish audience. He uses terms that Jews would understand and Gentiles wouldn't. He talks about celebrations and festivals that Jews would understand and Gentiles wouldn't, and he doesn't bother to explain them. Now, when you look at some of the other writers, they know they're writing to people who are not Jews. They will talk about a festival, and then they'll explain what the festival is because they're writing to people that they know don't know. So it's written to Jewish people, but it's written in Greek. Some say that it was first written in Hebrew, but there's not a whole lot of evidence to back that up. But Greek was the common language of the day, and he may have also been writing to a larger audience than just the Jews who were in Israel, because Jews who had been part of what they call the diaspora, dispersion. They were run out of Israel and they were all over the Roman world. They all spoke Greek. So it was a common language, so it's not unusual that he would write in Greek, even to a Jewish audience. So he's writing to people who should understand Jewish customs, Jewish values, and so forth. And his purpose is to assure these Jews, or to convince the Jews, that Jesus was the Messiah. Now, the word Messiah is a Hebrew word. We use the word Christ, and as he's writing in Greek, he uses the word Christ or Christos, because that's the Greek equivalent of Messiah. So they're the same word, and they mean basically the same thing. The promised one, the anointed one, the one who's going to be coming. And that goes all the way back to Genesis 3:15. And I don't have time to really go into that much, but in Genesis 3:15, we have what's the first promise of a Savior. It's where God is speaking to Satan. Well, I believe he's speaking to Satan. He's speaking to the serpent, literally, but I believe he's speaking to Satan there. He says, I will cause hostility between you and the woman, and between, that's Eve, by the way, and between your offspring and her offspring. Her offspring will strike your head, and you will strike his heel. In other words, you're going to damage him, but he's going to kill you. And we know, of course, that at the cross, that's exactly what happened, and we're waiting for the fulfillment of that last part. So the prediction of the Messiah who would be bruised but would strike a fatal blow to Satan is all the way back in the third chapter of Genesis. And from then on, we have repeated references to the coming of the Messiah. You know, the Jews, even to this day, when they refer to the Messiah, they refer to King Messiah. To them, the idea of King and Messiah are one and the same. They go together. Okay, King Messiah. And they would have to be the descendant of King David and King Solomon in order to be of the royal line. So Matthew is pointing these Jews that he's writing to, he's pointing them to the Messiah, Jesus. And he's pointing to them, therefore, because he's Messiah, he's also the King. And we're going to see that as we open chapter 1. So if you look at chapter 1, we're not going to read it. Okay, this is an overview, not a study in the particular verses. But if you just take an overview of chapter 1, the first thing you're going to see is something that you probably want to skip over. Right? It's like, oh, I think I'll just read something here. Let's take a look at the book of Numbers. And you get there and you go, wait a minute, what did I get myself into? Right? If you don't know what I'm talking about, later on, open to the book of Numbers and see what you get. It can be boring to read name after name after name after name after name, and most of them you've never heard of and really are not interested in learning much about, because you don't understand the significance of it. Well, that's the way Matthew starts out. A record, a genealogy of Jesus Christ, the Son of David. And we all go, oh. But if you were a Jew, you would say, all right, a genealogy. We're going to find out. Is he a true Hebrew? Is he a good Jew? Is he in good standing? What tribe is he from? See, all this stuff was very, very important to the Jews. So Matthew starts with the good stuff. We just haven't figured that out yet. So he starts with this, and he starts with Abraham and ends up with Joseph, and I'll let you figure out the rest in between. Except I'm going to tell you that he does something a little different. Normally, these genealogies don't include women, because women don't matter. Excuse me, didn't matter. Really, in a genealogy, the women didn't matter. So why would he do that? Well, there's another detail that we go into sometime. But he includes four women in this genealogy. Three of them he names by name, and one he alludes to. And that's an important thing to notice. that he does something so different there. Ends up with Joseph, the husband of Mary. Now, Joseph wasn't the biological father of Jesus. So why is he bothering with this whole genealogy? And he gets down here and says, and Joseph, who had nothing to do with the birth of Jesus. Well, not nothing, but physically nothing. Well, he's establishing the legal right, the legal inherency, right? He legally is the son of Joseph. And Joseph has royal lineage. So that's the genealogy of chapter 1 and points us to Jesus, the Messiah, the King. And by the way, Matthew, just another little sidelight here. In verse 17, he says, in case you haven't figured it out, that there are 14 generations in each of these three groups. Why does he tell us that? Well, because, once again, we're in a day when there's no internet. There's no computers. There weren't even any books. People didn't read. Everything had to be copied by hand. So you had to be quite somebody to be able to read and be able to get parchment and write. And it was an unusual thing. Not everybody could read. And so what did they do? They memorized stuff. And he's giving them a hint here. Hey, here's an important genealogy, and you can remember it. Split it up into three groups of 14, and that'll help you remember it. So he's just giving them a little mnemonic device there. The rest of the chapter is about something that we can't talk about in June because there's an unwritten rule that we can't sing Christmas songs or talk about Christmas before Christmas, right? Everybody sung a Christmas song recently? No. If Nate got up here next week and sang a Christmas song, we'd wonder about him, wouldn't we? What are you doing? We'd feel kind of funny. Well, that's okay. Here's a section on the birth of Jesus. And we see that Joseph is receiving a vision from God. And we see that a prophecy is being fulfilled. From Isaiah. So he's backing up this assertion that Jesus is the Messiah, that he's the one that's been promised and the one they've been waiting for. Then he goes to chapter 2 and he talks about some guys who are not Hebrew, are not Jewish. They are completely out of the picture here. And yet they're important. The Magi. They're important because they, in their studies of the Hebrew Scriptures, have come to the conclusion that Jesus is King. So he's backing up what he said in chapter 1 about the kingly lineage coming down to Joseph, and he's backing that up now with the Magi who bring gifts to the new King of Israel. And in it, we see that there are several prophecies that are fulfilled. So again, he's pointing to how the Old Testament prophets were predicting the coming of the Messiah King. And he says, yeah, they're going to be born in Bethlehem. He's going to come from Egypt. There's going to be the killing of all these little boys in Bethlehem. And there's going to be this connection with Nazareth. And all those things were prophesied. And Jesus fulfills all of these. Then we get to chapter 3. And in chapter 3, John the Baptist. You talk about the opposite of what would look like a royal lineage. If John the Baptist walked down the street and into our church here this morning, I don't think there's a one of us that wouldn't think there is something wrong with that man. And I think in our overview system that we use, we would say, I choose not to know that man well. And if he invites me for dinner, I'm not going because I don't like grasshoppers, you know? The guy was weird, okay? He's out here in the wilderness, and he's looks weird, he speaks weird, but what's his message? What's his message? His message has to do with the kingdom of heaven is near. Again, with the royalty. Again, with the king business. The kingdom of heaven is near. And he begins immediately criticizing the religious elite that were coming out there and probably laughing at him and making fun of him, as probably most of us would. Yeah, we're not, you know, I think sometimes we think, oh, I'm so good because, you know, I'm a Christian and I know better. And yeah, I don't think so. I think we would have done just what they were doing. So, you know, these religious leaders come in and he's telling them, you guys are claiming that you are sons of Abraham. Oh, wait a minute. Chapter 1, the genealogy began with Abraham. And yet, you guys are claiming you're sons of Abraham, but he completely shoves that aside because they neither believed nor behaved like children of Abraham. But he said, the one that's coming after me, the one that's coming after me, I'm not even fit to put his shoes on. He's superior to all of us. And that is demonstrated by how Matthew closes the third chapter. A voice from heaven. A voice from heaven. This is my son, whom I love, with whom I am well pleased. Yeah. So Matthew, in his introduction here, is setting us up for the fulfillment of Jesus being Messiah, King. And we're going to see that in the coming weeks if Brian sticks to the theme. We'll see. No, he can't miss it. So, again, going back to the vehicle, checking out a vehicle, we now have the general knowledge of this book. It's not a vehicle. I told you, all illustrations break down. So we know what it looks like. We've kicked the tires. We've checked the upholstery. And then in the coming weeks, Brian's going to take us under the hood and show us what's there and what's in the drivetrain. And he's going to get us studying the details and showing us how that all fits in to this overall theme of Jesus as Messiah and King. And at the end, what is that, 2 years? We get to the end? Whenever the end is here, we're all going to say, all hail King Jesus, because that's the theme. That's the message that he wants to bring us. Father, I want to thank you so much for giving us your word, for giving us those who brought your word to us. And we ask that even as we look and think about this general idea of what Matthew brought to us, that you would lay upon our hearts some small truth, and that mostly your Spirit would prepare us for the coming weeks, that we would understand a little bit now of where we're going as we look into this gospel and understand the importance of the Messiah, the King, in our lives. We ask it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast by Cornerstone Church of Ione. We hope that you found it encouraging and challenging. Please feel free to share this podcast with friends and family, and we will see you all next week.